Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Child Protection and Sport Unit. We're part of the NSPCC and funded by UK Sports Councils. Our work supports organisations to safeguard all children taking part in sport.
During this podcast, we'll talk about childhood sexual abuse. This may be difficult to hear, and for some people may bring up distressing memories, thoughts or feelings. We will include links to organisations that can support you alongside this podcast and on our website at thecpsu.org.uk. Whilst it may not be easy to listen to, this podcast includes important information to help all of us keep children safe in sport. And remember, if you're worried about a child, even if you're unsure, you can speak to the NSPCC helpline for advice. You can call 0808 800 5000 or email help@nspcc.org.uk. And if you're under 18, Childline staff are there for you, and you can call them on 0800 1111 or visit childline.org.uk. Hi, my name is Paul Stevenson. I'm one of the senior consultants at the Child Protection and Sport Unit. Today I'm being joined by Paul Stewart to talk about what we can all do to tackle childhood sexual abuse in sport. Paul Stewart was a former professional footballer, playing for teams such as Tottenham Hotspur, Liverpool and Man City, scoring in Tottenham's 2-1 FA Cup winning side in 1991 and winning caps as an England international. But today, Paul's going to talk to us about his current passion. As a person with lived experience of childhood sexual abuse, Paul is determined to raise awareness of what we can all do to protect our children and encourage safer spaces for all young athletes. Paul spends much of his week giving talks and presentations to young footballers in English Football League academies and their coaches and parents. Paul realises that all clubs may well have a safeguarding policy in place, but his presentation brings the reasoning behind those policies to life, highlighting what key things we need to do to protect children from abuse. Hello, thank you for working with us to produce this podcast. Hearing from those with lived experience is vital to help us understand how sexual abuse can happen. The aim of this podcast is to hear from you what practical things that individuals and organisations can do to keep children and young people safe in sport today. We know we need to accept that even with all the safeguarding requirements in place, the risk of a child being abused still remains. Therefore, we need to always be vigilant in sport to reduce that risk. Paul, you spoke out on the BBC's Darkest Secret documentary about sexual abuse within football. Can you tell us why you wanted to do this program and speak out?
Yeah, well, I came forward in November 2016, and to be honest with you, I was shocked at the amount of individuals that followed myself when I first came forward. So I was approached, as were the other guys that were in the program, to take part to explain what and how childhood sexual abuse can affect an individual. But I think it was important for everybody to know that it isn't just the individual that suffers from the abuse. It's the wider family circle that also it impacts on. So I thought that to take part in the program, it would help people understand maybe why individuals act the way they do, why they struggle with all sorts of emotional issues, and why they also go down the devastation route and experience the issues that they experience, whether that be through drugs, mental health issues, drink. You know, all that is what the effects of abuse can have on an individual.
Thanks, Paul. And you've been very articulate about how that ripple effects impacts on the whole family and also the wider clubs and those within the sports sector as well when abuse is disclosed. So can you tell us what sports clubs can do to help build a safe environment to help children feel safe?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is that we have policies and procedures in place. And what from my experience, what I've seen within grassroots sports is that individuals that want to perpetrate abuse will recognize where organizations don't have these policies and procedures in place, and they will infiltrate them organizations, and often it is too late for that organization to do anything, because they have already, they tend to be the nicest people you wish to meet. They come in, they infiltrate organizations, and they become the nicest person, and everybody, they gain the trust. And once they've gained that trust, Paul, that is when they can perpetrate the abuse, because anyone within the organization thinks it can't, no, it can't be that person. That person wouldn't do that.
And Paul, just as an aside from that, quite often we hear about people being in really powerful positions to be perpetrators and sexually harm children. But I suppose we know that you don't need to be the head of an organization. You don't need to be the Olympic coach. You don't need to be a premiership coach. It's about the power you have over that individual child in front of yourself, and that ability to manipulate the situation.
Yeah. And do you know what often happens, Paul, in organisations, especially sport organisations? These individuals, they might not be the leaders of the organisation, but they become what I can only explain as dream makers. And they often tell not just the individual that they're abusing, but they tell the parents, and they falsify dreams that they can help them progress in the support in the sport that they're actively working in. And when your dream and your only dream is to reach the top of that sport, then unfortunately you believe the perpetrator. And you know, as in my case, my only dream was to be a footballer ever since I could remember. And unfortunately, my coach said to me that for me to realize my dream, then I had to endure the abuse. And you know, as a 10-year-old, when the abuse started, that was something, although I didn't understand, because I was so desperate to be a footballer, I didn't say anything and endured the abuse for many years. I think a really important thing would be for me, and I've said this quite often, is that for the children to have voice, then I think they should have their own committee. You know, when I look back, when I was abused, it's difficult for a child to go to an adult. It's difficult for them to say, because as you know, these individuals, they're the most likable people in terms of the coaches, the parents, once they've infiltrated an organization. So a child is very unlikely to go to a coach or an adult and say, I think something wasn't quite right here. But if they have their own committees or a space in which they can talk amongst themselves, and, you know, they can either say what they like about the club and what they don't like, they're more likely to say, well, this happened to me and I thought it was a bit strange or a bit weird. And I think you'll find that children will open up more when they're talking to their own peers, you know, because sometimes it can be imposing, especially when you're young and you've got this person who's head of safeguarding. They've got that, that name, that badge, and you feel like that somebody might think they're in a position, or a child will think they're in a position of authority and be very reluctant to go and speak to them. So giving them that other option of talking amongst themselves, talking to one another, however that is organized, I think you're probably more likely to hear the voice of the child than expecting them and assuming that they will go to an adult.
Thank you, Paul. And I suppose you have talked in the past about what may have helped you when you were younger as well, and how things may have benefited you. And one of the things you talked about was about Childline, and how Childline could have, if it had been around when you were a young boy, because you talk about that 10-year-old child when the abuse started.
I was in a situation, and this is, you know, I talk from my own experience. I was in a situation where I felt felt isolated, Paul. You know, the perpetrator threatened to kill my parents and my brother. Again, I felt he had the power to give and take away the only thing that I wanted to be. I thought that if I told my dad would kill the individual and then he would go to prison and I'd lose my dad. So if there had been a organization which you could have gone to and felt that it was in confidence, then I think I may well have looked and pursued that opportunity. It's difficult to say at what age I would have done it, because as a young child, you know, it can be quite daunting to think that you're calling someone at the end of a phone that you don't know. But I think at least you would have felt that there is somewhere to go. And as you know, back in the mid-70s, you know, children were seen and not heard. Things like abuse were swept under the carpet and it wasn't in the public eye. So a lot of them reasons contributed into myself not really saying anything. But, you know, you look at Childline now and you look at where it is advertised, that it's in the press an awful lot. And as you know, it's close to my heart, because I think it is, for a lot of children, a way that they can report any issues that they are experiencing, whether that be in a sports setting or being in the familiar home. So, as you know, it's close to my heart, but I do wish I'd had the option, at least back when I was being abused, to think I could go somewhere for help. Because, as I say, you know, these individuals, they are very, very manipulative and very adept at isolating the child that they are abusing, whilst looking like they are the best thing since sliced bread to the rest of the family and the wider family.
Thank you, Paul. Just moving on to another question that I wanted to tease out with yourselves. How do you think we can move from simple compliance via checklists or standards assessments to creating a more robust safeguarding culture? Because we have had safeguarding standards around now for a number of years. The CPSU have worked with the sports councils across the UK and our partner organisation Children First in Scotland to ensure that those who are running sport do have safeguarding policies, the things that you alluded to earlier on, those sort of minimum standards in place. But just how do you think we can move from having those things in place to actually impacting on the culture of sport?
I genuinely believe that people with lived experience should be more involved with organisations, so that we can explain to parents, you know, what can and the dangers of not even asking the simple questions, Paul. And as you know, and we've spoken before, it is a bugbear of mine when a parent will take their child to an organisation they're just joining and they don't ask a few simple questions like, you know, do you have a safeguarding policy? If so, is it easy accessible? And then if I have a problem or my child has a problem, who do I report this to? Have you got the contact details? And then I think we make sure that the organisation doesn't just leave that safeguarding policy in the drawer. Do you know, they bring it out, give it legs and let it walk around the organization in the form of maybe feeding the children and parents little bits very often about safeguarding, putting signs up, you know, and discreet signs maybe in bathrooms, because we know that children don't often want their peers to see them writing numbers down. Well, if we put them in the back of cubicles of toilets or in discrete areas, we may well see that the children have more confidence in reporting things. So, you know, whilst some of the sports have made giant strides, I think that we can do an awful lot more, certainly at grassroots, to make sure that if anyone is looking to perpetrate any form of abuse, when they walk to that organisation and they see the procedures and they see what's happening around the organisation, then they will think twice of trying to infiltrate.
Yeah, and one of the other questions that you answered for me, Paul, you talked about the vulnerability of a club, of people targeting clubs and clubs not having certain things in place. So from what you've just said then, you think those sort of deterrents, the having the safeguarding policy, the vetting volunteers, the making sure people have codes of conduct, promoting who their welfare officer is, all those things you think would genuinely put someone off from targeting a particular organisation?
I do. I think they may well walk up to the organisation, Paul, and see that all them things are in place. You know, the fact that all the, you know, there are DBS checks. We are making sure that they are fit to do the work that they're doing at the club, and that's by taking references. You know, this is all something that should be second nature. It's good practice, and we talk a lot about good practice. And just doing them simple things, they will deter these individuals. Unfortunately, these individuals will then look at an organisation that isn't following them procedures, that isn't, in terms of safeguarding, looking after the children, making a safe environment, but also looking at what they should be doing to make sure that them children come in and they're at the organisation and they've got smiles on their face because they know that there is somebody to talk to. There are coaches that are versed in safeguarding. There are safeguarding officers in place. All these things, in my opinion, should be second nature to an organisation that has children involved in sport. And now what I would do if I was a governing body of that organisation, unless they had all this in place, Paul, I would sanction them and not allow them to be part of any league and to be part of any sort of associate league until they were compliant with what we've just spoke about, you know, with the procedures and the policies and, you know, even the, you know, as I said, giving the organisation maximum exposure in terms of what they are doing regarding safeguarding. And that should be when a parent takes a child to an organisation, the first thing they should do is sit down and they should go through all this content with them. So, you know, we talk about children being the most precious things that we have, yet we will take them to an organisation, leave them with an individual that we know nothing about, go off and go and pick them up, you know, 2, maybe 3 hours later. And I find it bewildering, especially with all the reports that we've seen on in the media from every sport. And I know we talked about football's darkest secrets, but abuse has touched almost every sport, Paul. And that can't be right. That can't be right in terms of our organisations doing enough so that parents, because I think sometimes parents look at it and they go, yeah, it happened there, but it won't happen here. I think that's the most dangerous thing a parent can think, that it happens everywhere else, but not in our organisation. These people live and breathe amongst us.
Well, I think you're quite right in that summary there around people live and breathe amongst us and things too. And that concept of it happens elsewhere is a dangerous concept and a real vulnerability for anybody, particularly parents to have. So I would agree with you that it's right that clubs and parents make themselves aware of the potential risks. But I think there's a real need for all parents, whether it's in the sports sector or in any voluntary sector, any after schools or clubs or activities, to make sure that they have a good understanding of how the club's well run, who to speak to if they have a concern. Those are key basic things we would encourage people to do. But the organisations need to be proactive and make sure that information is certainly available.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I agree with you on the fact that it doesn't matter where the child's activity is or whether it is after school or wherever that is. We've got to look and say, you know, because these people that were active in sport, they may now look at that sport and go, it's a bit difficult to perpetrate or to infiltrate, but that sport is nowhere near, and I'm talking about another sport, nowhere near as proactive as the football was. And they will move on to that sport, Paul, and whether it's in a school sector, whether it's in a gymnasium, whether it's in any other, you know, dance schools, these people will move on to where they feel that it's easiest for them to access the children. There is no doubt about that.
Thank you, Paul. And a number of years ago, I heard a researcher into the whole area of sexual violence just nail it very quickly for myself by saying you just cannot be a child sex offender without access to children. So that's people right. will often look for that access, and we really don't want any organization to be vulnerable, because vulnerable clubs lead to vulnerable children eventually.
You know, Paul, that unfortunately, you know, there isn't a cure. It's not like an illness that, you know, you can give them an injection like we've all had for the pandemic or medicine, and then all of a sudden they're okay. These people are incurable unless, of course, that, you know, they are having social or psychiatric treatment for it. But I still think that there's still a risk because of the nature of what their sexual preferences are. And I, you know, it's disappointing. It's worrying. They don't get rehabilitated in prison. They often come out and reoffend, as we know. So that makes it all the more important for us to make sure we're doing everything in our power to keep them away from our youngsters.
Thank you, Paul. And can I ask you another question specifically around sexual abuse? We know it can happen in different ways, and we know child sex offenders do not stand out as abusers and may well command significant respect within their community, family, or sports club. But do you think it's possible to spot what a child sex offender looks like?
We have this perception that paedophiles are—they're wearing scruffy macs, and you know they stand out because that's what the media perceive them as. But they're far from that. They're far from that. And I don't believe that you can look at someone and go, I think that person's an individual that wants to perpetrate abuse or any sort of abuse. I don't think it's possible to spot what a sex offender looks like. What you can spot is the behavior of a sexual offender, how they behave around organizations. You know, if we've got all the correct procedures in place, then whether it's a parent, whether it's a coach, whether it's a board member, if everything's in place, then you will see by the behavior of an individual that they're a sex offender, because they will try and manipulate situations. They will try and get a child on their own and coach them. They will try and get a child in the car and take them home, transport them. They will try and isolate that child. But if the organization, as we've spoken about earlier, if an organization has all the things that we spoke about in place, then it would be very, very difficult for a sex offender or an abuser to operate within that organization. And you've got to, you know, as parents, when your child is at an organization, you've got to feel that you can go and challenge the board members or the coaches or the leader of that organization and question the behavior of any individual at any given moment. And that is the way that you are able to spot if somebody is acting improperly at an organization.
Okay, and I suppose for us within the Child Protection and Support Unit, we're really keen to organizations through the training that we would encourage people to go on and raising their awareness, that people would understand how it's the behavior we need to consider. It's not what sort of person looks like, but it's actually how they behave, how they interact with a young person, how they may isolate a young person, and as you say, how they manipulate the parents that are there to care and act as the primary protector of those young people as well. So it's the more around the behaviour that we would encourage people to spot. And if they have a concern, then they need to do something with that concern and speak out. And as you've indicated, know who your welfare officer is, seek your welfare officer out and raise that concern. Or contact the NSPCC helpline as an option as well.
Yeah. You should always have the access to the numbers from day one when you're taking your child to any organisation. That should be the first thing or one of the first things that you ask for. Who do I contact? What's the name? I always say, you know, front and centre to safeguarding, and we call it FACS. You should have a button on your first page that says safeguarding, and you can press that and access any of the information that you need. We know that most people in sports and organisations do it for the right reason and they do great work, but we have to make sure that we don't become complacent.
Yes, and it's that, I suppose it's that complacency. So that idea that most people are good, honest people, but those good, honest people can still be manipulated. Okay, thank you. Paul, on a few occasions you've talked about the importance of the safeguarding lead officer and how key their role is to making sure that young people have a really positive experience in sport. What do you think sports clubs or governing bodies can do to support their safeguarding lead officer?
Well, I think we make safeguarding at the forefront. But, you know, sometimes we talk a lot about the individuals that perpetrate abuse, Paul, but I know and you know that the majority of people involved in sport do it for the right reasons. They do it because they want the child to have the best experience they can. But we have to be aware that if we don't have the right measures in place, and what I mean by that is that not just the safeguarding officer being responsible for the organisation, but committee members, coaches, even parents, moreover, recognising the importance of safeguarding and making sure that they are versed to some extent in safeguarding, and then they will see that the organisation and the children within that organisation are doing what they love to do, and they're doing it in a safe environment, because we're all taking responsibility. It's not just one person's job.
Thanks, Paul. Can I ask, just in closing, can you say what has aided your recovery and helped you manage the effects of your abusive experiences?
It is a question, Paul, that I get asked often, and I can only be honest in my answer is that, you know, I didn't say anything for 42 years, and it isn't like switching a light on and off, and then all of a sudden, you know, you recover from the effects of the abuse. But what I feel helps me is, or I feel that I manage it an awful lot better now, Paul. You know, when I'm having not so good days, then the first thing, I don't go and turn to destructive behaviour. I don't turn to drink. I don't turn to drugs. I try and manage it, and I try and talk about it. I wouldn't advise either way for anyone to go public like I did. You know, that's a massive decision that one has to make, because your life does change. But for me, you know, even doing this podcast, I'm going off to Stoke City today. I do outside of just football. You know, as difficult as it is for me to recount my story, it helps me. It's cathartic for me. And once I have finished my sessions, then the thought that it might have helped an organisation to think more about safeguarding, to think, you know, more about the dangers, and moreover, think about the children that are in their charge, because, you know, we want these children, we want them to flourish, we want them to grow, and we want them to enjoy sport. So all that, I suppose, together is helping my recovery, rather than, you know, I am recovered, if that makes sense.
Thank you, Paul, for your honesty and directness today in what sports clubs, parents, coaches, and all volunteers can do to keep young people safe and make sure that their experience is as much fun as possible. Just in summing up, a couple of the points I wanted to recap before we let people go today and end this podcast. So a few things you highlighted in particular were the importance of prioritising safeguarding at all level, so that it's the only way to create a real safe culture within an organisation, that sports clubs are proud of the policy that they have in place, proud that they have done all they can to ensure that their club is a listening club and a safe club for young people. The importance of every organisation having a safeguarding policy that's communicated to everyone. And you even mentioned the importance of making sure that policy is so accessible and available to people on organisations' websites or shared with people when they join the clubs, and not just sitting on the shelf, but as a real live document. Thirdly, you also mentioned the importance of every organisation having a welfare officer, and that welfare officer is known to everybody in the club, including young people, and the people know how to contact them as well. But one of the key things for that welfare officer is that they have that support from their board members and other club officials as well, so they're not left isolated and vulnerable themselves. And the fourth thing you mentioned was the importance of a child's voice and a club actually being that listening club. So encouraging the development of a young people's forum demonstrates not only that the club is willing to listen to the young person's concerns about how the sport is run, how the club is run, and the administration around that, but just demonstrate that this is a club where adults within that organisation want to hear the voice of a young person. And very few clubs currently have that sort of youth forum established within organisations. And we know that adds an additional protective factor to young people as well, so they can reach out to their peers, but also have a method of reporting to the board or to club coaches around any concerns they have. Fifthly, and one of the key things that's a real challenge for us in our society is to accept that abuse can happen, and certainly that it does happen within sport, and it can happen in each of our individual clubs and organisations as well. If we're not vigilant, if we don't make our club or our organisation a cold house for those people who will want to target to abuse children as well. And lastly, one of the most important things we can do is build a parent's confidence to help the parent understand what they can do to contribute to the young person's enjoyment and safety in their club, to make sure parents are confident and competent enough to ask the questions to ensure the club that their child's going to is a safe club, a well-run club, and a club that prioritises the welfare of all children. Paul, once again, thank you very much for your time, and we will have, as I said, a number of support organisations referenced on our website for those who are listening to this podcast. So thank you very much again.
Thanks for inviting me on, Paul.
Thank you for listening to this Child Protection in Sport Unit podcast. If you're looking for more information and resources on safeguarding children in sport, please visit our website at thecpsu.org.uk.